Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 47, The Origins of Rome, Part 2. I strongly suggest that you look at Charles Kovacs' wonderful book, Ancient Rome. It's a trove of very, very good stories, and I'm not going to try to repeat too many of the stories that he tells, though sometimes I may go over some of his ground in order to illuminate one or another aspect of Roman life. He gives a good retelling of the story of the Sabine women, and it's important for us to see here again that the Venus forces, which work so strongly through Aeneas, are definitely overshadowed by the Mars forces as we go further along in Roman history. And we see then how Romulus, the son of Mars, founds a city which is all male. He has to attract beggars and exiles and outlaws and all of those men who cannot fit into the culture of their time, usually because of their aggressive behavior, because they're antisocial in nature. So it's only to be expected that the way in which they're going to find wives is by forcing them, is by bringing them in a deceitful way. But then, remarkably enough, it all turns out happily ever after when the wives reveal how they have fallen in love with their husbands. And then we have the Romulus's work of creating this new city, and he divides it very early on into the patricians and the plebeians. So the patricians, like Romulus himself, were there at the very beginning. The plebeians are those who come later. And this division, this polarity between upper and lower, not yet really a nobility, but certainly one based on ownership of land, later on wealth, and finally on title as well, is there from the outset. And then he rules for 37 years, a number that comes back here and there in Roman history, a period that could be called akin to a moon node, in which something really fulfills itself in a complete way. And then it's said that a thunderstorm arose once when Romulus was reviewing his army, and that Mars appeared and pulled him away from the earth. And then Numa became the next king, elected by the Senate. So there's already a Senate in place. Now, this too is something that Romulus created, made up traditionally of members of the patrician class. And also, later on, it became codified that one had to be 50 years old before one could be appointed a senator. So the senators were older men, men who had overcome their passions, theoretically overcome their own selfish desires, and now were willing to work for something larger than themselves. And then we have Numa, who, as a king, also ruling for about 37 years, is as peaceful and non-aggressive as Romulus was a warrior. And he refused to sacrifice humans anymore, and Jupiter agreed with this. This was to be a very big difference between the Romans and the Carthaginians later on in the waging of war. And Numa then was very much the religious founder of the city. So we have the military foundations laid by Romulus and the religious foundations. And one then sees the conflicts that occur as the next five kings arise. And we have an interesting story about the three Horatii. There was a conflict, a battle with the people of Alba Longa, and it was determined that the war, the battle, would be decided by combat between three young Roman warriors who were called the Horatii and three young Alban warriors who were called the Curiaci. It was a very, very fierce battle. Two of the Horatii were killed, and all three of the Curiaci brothers were wounded, but not killed, but they were quite weak. And the Romans were watching this terrible battle, and then, to their dismay, the only living Horatius turned his back on the Curiaci brothers and began to run away from them. They ran after him in pursuit, but they were weak, they were losing blood, and they grew weaker and weaker. And at that moment, he turned around and was able to vanquish all three of them. And the Romans were so grateful that they crowned him with a wreath, and amid singing and dancing, he was led into the city. Now, as he came into the city, his sister hurried to meet him, but she had been betrothed to one of the Curiaci. Well, now everyone watched. Would she be true to her Roman brother or to her Alban fiancé? As her brother moved forward, she saw that he carried over his arm the robe that she herself had embroidered for her lover. It was filled with his blood. She saw it, and she began to weep in her agony and her grief. And then Horatius took out his sword and killed his sister, saying, "So perish any Roman woman who laments a foe." Here again, this fratricide, sororicide, the killing of one's own family member because of one's allegiance to Rome. This is also going to be very strongly embedded in the story, something that we'll hear again and again. Now, Rudolf Steiner has said that the seven kings of Rome prefigure the entire history of Rome, all the way from its humble beginnings to the time of its empire and eventual decadence. So I wouldn't spend terrible amounts of time on the kings, because the legends are often kind of sparse. But just to show the students the alternation, you know, of a good king, not so good king, a very good king, a much less good king, and finally then a much more decadent quality to be found right at the end with Tarquinius Superbus, Tarquin the Proud, and his sons. His ascent to the throne, in which he stabs his father-in-law to death. It was said that the blood flooded the steps to the Senate, and Tarquinius's wife showed up in her chariot. There's her father's blood seeping down. Her horses slip in the blood. She slips in the blood as she gets out of the chariot and rushes and embraces her husband, who is himself filled with his father-in-law's, her father's blood. Quite a picture of an ascent to the throne of the last of the Roman kings. You have a picture there with Tarquinius the Proud and his sons, so much of an image of the modern dictator, the story one hears again and again nowadays as one dictator after another is deposed, sometimes only to ascend again. And then we have the figure of Brutus, Brutus, who was spared being killed by Tarquinius Superbus, even though he was a relative of the king who had been killed, because he acted really dumb. And Kovacs tells a wonderful story of how Brutus learned of the prophecy from the Sibyllic books, and knows then that it is his task to take Rome its next step, and finally becomes the first leader of Rome, the first consul in the Roman Republic, when Tarquinius Superbus is overthrown. Now, what happened shortly after Brutus's ascent was that he learned that the Etruscans, who had been stirred up by Tarquinius Superbus to try to overcome Rome once again, the Etruscans had already fomented a conspiracy in which Brutus was going to be assassinated. However, the perpetrators had been captured, and they were awaiting Brutus's judgment. And Brutus, of course, knew that they had to be executed, and then he learned that the perpetrators were his own sons, that they had been bought by the Etruscans, bribed, so that they were willing to plot to do their father in. What should he do now? Here we are once again, this family story. We've seen brother against brother, brother against sister, now father against sons. What should he do? Now, at this point, when you come across incidences like this in Roman history, and they are legion, where a decision has to be made, one interesting and enjoyable thing that you can do is to have the children organize a debate. They don't know yet what the outcome of the story is going to be. And of course, they have to promise not to look it up or to go on Google and search for it. But instead, you have two teams represented, perhaps each one of them by one or two students. And they each take sides, and based on what they already know of Roman history, such as its bloody precedents, they argue one side or the other. No, Brutus should hold his family first, forgive his sons, or perhaps exile them at the most. And then the other side, no, loyalty to Rome, fealty to Rome is the most important thing. It wasn't just their father, they were violating the code of the state of Rome itself. So use this occasion, teach the children the laws of debating, the rules of debating, how to turn the other's argument against him, but always make it a kind of review of what they've learned thus far. So now we stand at the end of the Seven Kings, the beginning of the Republic. This is the central part wedged in between the kings and the empire. And in here, we really have the heart of Rome. Here we're going to meet some of the very finest and noblest Romans that there were, and also see the remarkable achievements of Rome in many realms of life. So our next lecture will enter into the world of the Roman Republic.